From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We are broadcasting on the road with a live audience both hours today. And in hour two, we welcome some local leaders as we talk about the problem of poverty in Rochester that has been, it's not a 10-year problem, but in many ways this hour, it's a conversation about where we have been, where we are, and where we are going. In our first hour, you heard from people who are having lived experience of poverty. You heard from a woman who is a recipient of GBI that we're going to talk about a little bit more this hour. And they talked a lot about the stereotypes, the stigma, and the reality of poverty. This hour, we take a look at the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, its goals, and what local leaders say is the reality of poverty now and what might change in the future. Everyone wants to see change. It is not easy. But it has been very, very difficult to move the needle or the numbers. Rochester remains in the top five cities in the country on a list you don't want to be on of cities its size, of poverty, of extreme poverty, and of children, nearly half of Rochester's children growing up in poverty. Let me welcome our guests. We're going to talk about their perspective on this issue and the work that they're doing. Rochester Mayor Malik Evans is here. Mayor, thank you for being here.
Good to be with you.
Also with us is DeMario Strickland, Interim Superintendent of the Rochester City School District. Superintendent Strickland, thank you for being here.
Great afternoon.
Welcome to Aqua Porter, Executive Director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Hello, Aqua.
Hello, Evan.
Simeon Bannister, President and CEO of the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Get real close to your microphone, everyone, when you're speaking. Thank you, Simeon.
Good to be here today.
We're going to start with the mayor because the mayor's time is very limited and he's generous with his time. And I'm just going to ask you just generally from the start here, Mayor, how do you see the question of poverty in the city? And then we'll talk more specifically. How do you see this issue and where are we?
Well, it's a complex issue. And one of the things I tell people is if you think you got a silver bullet, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. It is not a problem that is easily fixed with one program or one solution. Now, often we find that people will say, if we just do this one thing, we'll solve poverty. But I think we have a pretty good case on the things that we know work. There's some national policies that we can do that can absolutely transform poverty. But I think it requires a coordinated approach in order to get people to be able to lift themselves up out of poverty. And it has to be a intergovernmental, collaborative approach. The government cannot solve it alone. The not-for-profit sector cannot solve it alone. Foundations can't solve it alone. The schools can't do it alone. We have to work collectively to do that. What do we know? We know, for example, during the pandemic, childhood poverty went down. It was almost cut in half. I think it was 46% because we had the extension of the earned income tax credit. After that period passed, guess what? Childhood poverty is right back to where it is. So we know that there are certain things that work, so we should be able to support those things. One of the things that we supported at the city is our guaranteed basic income program. We had some people that said, oh, these people, and usually when they say these people, they usually mean black people. They say these people are just going to spend their money and they're going to be frivolous and waste it. Well, guess what? We're starting to get data back. Most of them spent it on saving for school, paying their rent, paying for a car or basic other needs. Most of them continued to work while they were doing that, but they've been able to, guess what? Improve their situation. We know that workforce development, good coordinated workforce development programs work, that if you have all these jobs that are out there and you're able to give people the skill set in order to rise to the occasion and meet the skills of those jobs, and those jobs can lift them out of poverty, that will help them. We know childcare is another barrier that is an issue for people that are living in poverty because they shouldn't have to choose whether or not they have to go to work or whether or not they have to stay home because they can't afford the childcare, and that becomes a vicious cycle. So there are things like that that are policy decisions that we can make. But we also saw in Rochester that we had to not forget about history. Of all of our greatest rewards, history is the greatest teacher. You think it's a mistake that the 14605 zip code, that if you lived on Thomas Street and your house was dilapidated and you don't have the value that you have somewhere else, that just happened in 2022? No, it happened like that because we had redline areas. So what we have said is, let's go into those redline areas, work with individuals because we know that housing is an absolute, should be a right, and should be a priority. And one of the ways in which you can build wealth in a community is by making sure that people own homes. The black-white wealth gap is absolutely ridiculous in this country. It's even worse in Monroe County. So we have a greenlining program where we said that if people don't see the benefits of building in Rochester, then we'll use federal funds in order to greenline. So we built 32 houses over in the Northeast, 14605 and Thomas Street, and we're building another 32 over on Superior Street in that area as part of our Bullshead project. And we're going to target it to individuals who have been traditionally redlined, which are mainly Black people. So we have to make sure that we are honest about these conversations to understand the historical context. Because if you don't understand the historical context of poverty and how some of this has been set up, you will not be able to change it. So it's not that we're blaming anybody, but those of us that are gatekeepers now, which I am one, and guess what? Everybody in your audience is also a gatekeeper. Everyone on this panel is absolutely a gatekeeper, whether or not you're Black, white, blue, or purple. There are things that you can do within your respective places and stations to be able to move the needle on poverty. And it's just not the mayor's job. It's just not the superintendent's job or going to my good friend Simeon Bannister to say, give me money to be able to solve poverty or expecting Aqua and Ramapi to do it by themselves. All of us have a role to play in making sure that we shape and change poverty regardless of what your title is. So that's kind of where I see poverty. I think we should not have poverty because we know what we need to do. It's just a matter of having the political will to do a lot of it, and a lot of it is with other levels of government, including the federal government.
See if I can fit in two questions for the mayor before we let him go. And again, he's generous with his time. We very much appreciate that. Former President Barack Obama brought up housing at the recent Democratic National Convention. He said that Democrats need to be introspective when their policies have come up short, and President Obama has concluded too many cities, in his words, with Democratic leadership, have put up too many barriers to creating new housing and increasing the housing stock, lowering the price of housing. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, I agree with it. And it's just not even Democratic cities. It's all over. Because even if you look in some suburban districts here in Rochester, when they think affordable housing, they think city. There are still towns in the city of Rochester that have restrictive covenants where they don't want affordable housing. Now, they think they're hurting Black folks, right? But guess what? The some of the main folks who will benefit from affordable housing are poor white folks. But they think that we don't want those people there. We know what they're saying when they say those people. They're mainly talking about Black people. But affordable housing is something that needs to be built all over the place. And why should it just be built in the city? But because of the way the zoning laws are out there, it doesn't happen. Now, in Rochester, we've embraced it. We've embraced it in Rochester. We're probably one of the number one city in New York State in terms of the building of affordable housing. But we also know that we want to build all types of housing, also single family homes, because many of the people living, and I want to give a shout out to RHA, who's in the audience. I was bragging about them yesterday to the HUD regional representative. We are thinking creatively to see how we can move people out of affordable housing to make space for other people and then get them in single family homes that they can own by converting affordable housing vouchers. But guess what? You just can't do that in the city of Rochester. And some of us have not been brave in our suburban communities, particularly across New York State and other places where there are Democrats and others who are running those cities. And we have to be honest about that. And as a result, that's why you have a lot of the housing crisis. You cannot just look to the urban centers to be able to have the housing crisis. So if you live in the suburbs, you can't have your Black Lives Matter flag, talk about how much you love Black folks, but then you get nervous when it's time to build an affordable housing place out in your community. So we just have to be honest about that. And a lot of the rhetoric does not equal the actual practice in which we have. And I think that that's what the president was saying, and that's what we need to make sure of. I'll give one last example. Crean Commons was a affordable housing program, a project that was built in Chi-Lai. I was on Pathstone Enterprise Center board, and they were supportive of this. The community fought it at first, but guess what? They ended up opening up that affordable housing project, and guess what? Chi-Lai is still doing pretty well. And it's actually a diverse affordable housing project, but how many other inner ring suburbs or outer ring suburbs have opened up their eyes to open up affordable housing because of the quote unquote stigma that's there? So the president is right on there.
All right, last question for the mayor. I want to share the story of what's happening in the city of Detroit. This year, the New York Times reported that there's a number of conflicting storylines coming out of Detroit. It's a rare American city that had a population decline for decades, and for the first time in a long time, its population is going back up. So that looks like a good thing. It's arresting that trend. Second, it has seen a rather sharp increase in a number of metrics, jobs, housing prices, outside investment. But the New York Times story on the Detroit comeback adds that, quote, the Renaissance is concentrated in 7 square miles of a city 20 times that size. New amenities like the quaint Q-Line streetcar stop at the edge of downtown and never reach most residents, end quote. Mayor, how can Rochester revitalize in a way that, doesn't concentrate success in a small geographic part of the city?
You can't concentrate in this. And first off, let me say, Mayor Duggan is probably one of the best mayors of America. I mean, he turned around Detroit. His first thing he had to do was, I was blessed in Rochester because our streetlights were working. One of his biggest accomplishments was getting all the streetlights working. Imagine that, if I was running for mayor and I said, the first thing I'm going to do is get the streetlights working. That's like saying, that's like somebody being a father and saying, oh, I take care of my kids. You're supposed to do that, right? That's like regular metrics, right? But Detroit was so far gone when he took office that, that was some of his metrics. So Detroit has had a great story. But one of the things that you have to make sure of in a city, and I've learned this, is that you have to work from the middle out. And in the middle out is the quote-unquote inner city, whatever the hell that means. I said, no one still has been able to give me a definition of what the inner city is. Usually that means poor black people. But inner city, you have to look at looking to expand in all those areas. So when we look at, for example, our Inner Loop project, that's going to be a $100 million plus project, we're making sure that we are going to do it in a way where individuals that were displaced or were a part of that that neighborhood, that they're involved there, and that you have policies where people can stay in their homes, but also contribute in an economic development way to the projects that you are doing there, that you are doing, because you don't just want to concentrate on one area. You have to look at where you're doing it. Hence why we picked, and people thought we were crazy, the most impoverished neighborhood in the city is where we picked to build homes. Because if no one wanted to go first, then it wouldn't happen. So you have to do that. Right? So I was like, okay, we'll go first. We'll go on Thomas Street. And now look what we did. Not only did we invest in terms of building new homes on Thomas Street, we went to the state of New York and said, hey, we built some new homes, but we don't want a burned out, dilapidated structure to it. So can we help Ms. Jones, who's been living in her house for 50 years, also improve her house that's next to that old house, that new house that's there? So then you're lifting up the entire neighborhood. So you have to do that, but you can't neglect any area. But you still got to have a vibrant downtown, which is what we're working on the corner of Main and Clinton. So you have to look at it holistically. You can't just concentrate on one area. You have to do it in a way in which everyone feels as though they're included, and you have to lift up the entire city. And you also can't forget about the people that have lived there. Hudson Avenue, ladies and gentlemen, there are grandmothers, or as someone told me today, they call them LOLs, little old ladies. That Niner Davis gave me that word, that have lived in these neighborhoods for 40 and 50 years, that guess what? They don't want to go anywhere. So we need to make sure that if we're developing a house next to them that it takes $400,000 to build, that they can maintain their chance of living, so they then can pass that on to their relatives and friends, their relatives or a friend if they want to sell it to them. That is absolutely critical. You can't just start lifting up and forget about the people that have been there, through urban removal. When you put highways through their neighborhoods, where you put ExxonMobil plants next to their place, and then say, oh yeah, we're making this all nice. Oh, and by the way, we want to buy your house and move you out. No, you need to make sure you still can maintain what they have, and then bring in any other people that might want to come. That's what you have to do, and that's how you make sure you keep you keep people rooted in their community, and the community does not live the people who have invested and put their blood, sweat, and tears there for decades. I think that's what you have to make sure you do, and I think that 7 miles is a cautionary tale, but it's also something that we can learn from Rochester, because they have gained population, they have done a lot of good stuff.
A lot of good metrics in Detroit, too. Absolutely. Hey, our thanks to Rochester Mayor Malik Evans for making time for the program today.
Thank you, everybody.
Mr. Mayor, I know he's got to get out of here. If you are just joining us, listeners, we are broadcasting live from the MCC Downtown Campus, right across the road from WXXI, and it is part of RMAPI's summit. The Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative is having a summit today. They're taking stock of where poverty is in this community, what programs, what initiatives are happening, who's working together, who can still be pulled into this effort, and what it looks like going forward. And the executive director of RMAPI is Aqua Porter, who is with us. And, I want to start by asking you, Aqua, when I look back at the conversations I had with Ed Doherty and many others 10 years ago, he was saying, don't ask us what's going to change in a year. Don't ask us how we fix this in 3 years. Give us 10, 15, 20. And it's been roughly 10, and the numbers are still really troubling. The child poverty numbers should break all of our hearts. Roughly half of Rochester's children in child poverty. Many families and children in extreme poverty, which means they're living at less than half of the poverty line. And I want to just take your temperature on where you see poverty right now, and if you feel like there's evidence that some of this work is working.
So, yes. In fact, I think you mentioned in the first hour of the comptroller's report that had a chart that showed poverty rates across the major cities in New York State. And if you look, I think it started back in the early 2010s, and it's kind of goes through 2021. And there is a steady decline in the poverty rate in most of the big New York State cities. But the Rochester poverty rate decline is steeper and faster than the other upstate cities. So there is, you know, it is about 10 points difference, around 8 to 10 point difference between 2013 and now. Certainly not the 50% reduction that their aspiration was back in 2015. And slower and harder than we would want, but there has been some decline. It's not enough. The same with the child poverty rate. You know, children aren't poor by themselves. They're poor because their parents are poor. And in Rochester, we were hovering above 50%, like 50.2, 50.3%. And now we're down at 41% of the poverty rate for children in the city of Rochester, which is about a 10-point drop, but still way too many. Like, we're still the city with the fifth highest child poverty rate in the country of cities our size. So we know that we know that it's not enough. We must do more. We have solutions. We've talked about some of them today. We've talked about some of them even in the first half hour. We know that there are things that we can do. And we know that if we don't, we have consequences in our community that are generational. We know that if our children continue to live in poverty, that their life expectancy is lower, that their health is worse off, that their opportunity for economic stability is less. And we know that that is, I don't think that that is a place where we want our community to be. So, you know, we have to keep working at it.
And Aqua, just watching your reactions in the first hour, I'm going to assume that you are in favor of a UBI or GBI program.
Evan, I was there at the beginning when this was initially announced in the city of Rochester, and there was like visceral frustration with people saying you don't want that. But our MAPI was stood at the forefront of saying, pushing the city at the time, the mayor at the time, to try it. Let's see what happens. And we were so excited when it got the support of city council to do this pilot. We knew, but with all the evidence around the country of other cities that had done this, that this could make a big difference in families' kind of well-being.
Yeah, and I should say that I don't want to speak for the mayor, but when he's been on the program in the past, what he has essentially said is, the city of Rochester may not be able to do this in perpetuity. We want to prove that we think it can work, and we want to put heat on the federal government to do more of a UBI or something that looks more like the GBI-UBI model. Are you on that? Are you on board with that?
Yes, and I think that, you know, Rochester signed early on to the mayors for a guaranteed income program with other mayors in the country. Now it's even become county executives, which was that, in fact, that was the model. Like, let's prove it in a bunch of cities and then use that as leverage and push at the federal level to see if we can get like a federal GBI program. And so I know that that is a lot. There's so much evidence that says that this is the right thing to do. There's like no question. I've never seen a study that has been done that I've read about that would say that this is not what is really good for people and that it makes a difference in people's lives. And yet we can't find the political will to make it happen. We can't find the political will to put the earned child tax credit, extend that. It was ridiculous.
That may change. And some of your colleagues from the Children's Agenda, I think, are here, and they have supported the child tax credit at the federal level, well, really at all levels. We are seeing that as part of this presidential campaign. I would not surprise me to see it back. But set that aside. I know that's something you support as well. Mm-hmm. There's two other things briefly I just want to ask you about before I turn to your colleagues on stage. Part of our MAPI's policy agenda has been raising wages and decriminalizing poverty. And on June 28th, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision that deals with homelessness. The court decided that cities can punish people for sleeping in public. In its biggest decision on homelessness in really decades from everything I've read, the U.S. Supreme Court says cities have the right to ban people from sleeping and, quote, camping in public places, and that they can determine, you know, their own sanctions, penalties, for people often who are homeless who do so. Now, I don't see Mayor Evans cheering that. I don't think that that is necessarily something that his administration, I don't want to speak for them. I want to ask you if that's part and parcel what you're talking about when you say poverty and homelessness can be criminalized.
I think it's an example of criminalizing poverty. I don't think that we've seen that as an issue in Rochester, and I was actually not surprised by the Supreme Court's decision based on what the Supreme Court has been deciding lately. But I do think that it represents this idea that we don't really care about people who are struggling. Like, we don't really care about people who are different. We don't really care to really support people who have needs above what they can't do and earn on their own. And I think it was just cruel. Like, I think the court case came out of Seattle, Washington. Was that where it was? I think it was somewhere like
somewhere
Washington,
in the West
Oregon.
Coast. Yeah, yeah.
And it was people who could not find housing. Like, they were not shelters enough for them. There were not beds that they could go to. And so they went and slept in this park. And they were, they fought this and ultimately they lost. But I just think that it's a failure of what we believe our government is supposed to do to take care of its people. And I think it's just cruel.
Let me turn to Simeon Bannister, who is the president and CEO of the Rochester Area Community Foundation. If there's anything I've learned from you over the years, it's a lot of things, but I'll say two things. One is that we must, and by we, I mean journalists, people with a microphone, hold people accountable. The people who have the power to make change or the people who have the power to cause harm, we must hold them accountable. And the second is to understand and appreciate the complexity and how deeply entrenched a lot of the problems in our society are, and to understand that that complexity doesn't mean they cannot be solved, but they may not be solved in a day or a month or a year. And I sit here on this stage thinking, part of me is just, you know, as a citizen of Rochester, just frustrated that, as Aqua is, that poverty is where it is, that this many kids are growing up in poverty, that we have extreme poverty. But I don't think for a second that the people who have been working on this, whether it's a decade or 100 years, don't care. I think people care. So how do you see where we are now and, you know, how to be firm, how to be bold, how to be direct, while appreciating the complexity of this problem?
Yeah, absolutely. Excuse me. I take a lot of motivation in response to this question from our dear ancestor and sister Maya Angelou, who told us that you do your best until you know better. And then when you know better, you do better. And so when I think about the journey that our MAPI has been on, it strikes me that there were a lot of folks of goodwill and good intention at its outset that tried to set some audacious goals in terms of how we could ameliorate this scourge in our community. But it's been very difficult for us to make some of that progress. But guess what? We are learning along the way. And one of the things I'm so excited about is lifting up this idea in our MAPI of upward mobility. And the reason why I'm excited about it is that it focuses certainly on economic success, but it also focuses on power and autonomy. It also focuses on dignity and belonging. And someone listening might say, well, what has that got to do with poverty? Why are those aspects so important here? And what I want to offer you is that we have been bequeathed this legacy, this puritanical legacy, that has often conflated merit with economic success. Now, follow me. If we think about the implications of merit and economic success, we heard in the last hour how hard people that are dealing with the affliction of poverty have to work. Do y'all know that between 6 and 12% of the US GDP comes from the gray economy? Where I come from, we call that hustling. So We have a lot of folks that are working really hard, but not being economically rewarded. But think about the flip side, because we always talk about that part of the equation. But let's just flip to the other side of the equation. And I'm going to ask listeners to do something that they don't often do, which is to disassociate some of the isms, capitalism, socialism. Let's put that to the side for a second and just talk practically. The higher likelihood, it is much higher likelihood, that if you earn more and if you have more wealth, that you are more likely to participate in creating passive income. Investments, stocks, and so on and so forth, real estate. And by definition, it's called a passive income because you don't have to
work.
But wait a second. I thought that the whole equation was that if you work harder, you get more. So if that equation doesn't work out, then maybe we need to rethink some of the opposition that we've seen across this country, in our society, in our community, to things like guaranteed basic income, to things like the child care tax credit, the earned income tax credit. The last thing I'll say about this is, anybody in the room ever play poker? Anybody ever play poker? Have you played poker in the room? I'm not a huge poker player, not that good at it, but I will tell you that the way that poker works is that typically in this game, everybody's got some chips, and if you are a better player than everyone else, you start to acquire all the chips. And the game ends when no one else has any
chips.
Now, the funny thing is that that's true even if the best player at the table is the best because of merit. Let's say that they just know the game better. Even if that's the case, if they get all the chips, the game is
over.
And we don't want the game to end, do we? And so what we also recognize is that there's a lot of people that are holding those chips, and they ain't been playing fair. We got cards up the sleeve. We move the goalposts. We change the rules. But our economy isn't that dissimilar. I absolutely agree with so much of what the mayor said. But the one thing I will say is that many of the symptoms of poverty are complex, but the root cause ain't that complex. And so the question for us is the will that we have to change these circumstances. And I'm excited about how we build power, autonomy, dignity, and belonging throughout this community to create that kind of change that we want here.
Superintendent Strickland, you have to follow that.
No.
The interim superintendent, DeMario Strickland, is here. And I do want to ask you a question that that maybe puts you in an awkward position, but I want to go back to some of what Ed Doherty told me a decade ago. He said we should be furious about what's happening to kids.
Yes.
We should. It is a moral stain, what's happening to kids.
Yes.
And Ed said, you know, that for decades of his work in government, there have been educational reformers. People had this idea, how can this poor district still succeed? And people get paid a lot of money to fly around the country and advise districts that have a lot of poverty on what they could do differently. And most of the time, it doesn't change much. That's not to say, again, that there's not great intention. Mm-hmm. But what he said was, we have to be honest about how difficult it is. It's not impossible. He said, I want to say it's not impossible. But if you don't believe it is much harder to have this much poverty and have a lot of success from your kids in academics, in school, and then in life, then you are not living in reality. And I want, as the superintendent, I mean, no one wants to think, well, it's impossible, it's nearly impossible. I mean, you're working every day, I know, to give kids a chance.
Absolutely.
But what does poverty do to a district like yours?
Well, poverty does a lot. But I want to first start out by saying, when you're looking at a person that experienced childhood poverty, you're looking at me, the current superintendent. And one of the things that have plagued the district, in my honest opinion, is that we lead with poverty. Because the student is impoverished, we cannot teach them, or we need to do all of these interventions differently. We need to catch them up. We need to just provide all these wraparound services when sometimes all we do is need to just educate them. We need to make sure that we are teaching them at grade level. And when you have a bunch of folks that lead with that, that starts catching on. It becomes rampant in our schools, in our community, that, you know what, we can't teach those kids because they are really bad and they come to us with all these problems. And, you know, every excuse in the book that's connected to poverty, and even with the things that we say about the individuals that are in our communities that are very impoverished. What I will say is that the Rochester City School District, even though our primary job is to educate, we have taken on a lot more, and that we are looking for ways that we can solve some of those issues that generally plague impoverished students, such as healthcare. We have schools that have school-based health clinics. We're trying to bring practitioners into our buildings so that we don't let the different excuses on why a child can't be in school actually become more pervasive. We have our community schools model. We are providing wraparound services where it includes food pantries, education for families, the parents, to actually do some of these or learn about some of these different initiatives that they don't know about, including how to go about getting housing and things of that nature. So there's so many different things that we now have to come to the table with just to bring the students out of these slumps that has actually taken away from some of the basic things that educators are there to do, which is to teach kids how to read, which is to teach kids how to do arithmetic. And it's going to take a whole community approach in doing that.
Can you also let listeners know what kind of effect you think a change, a truly transformational change? And again, I take your point. I don't want to just say, well, there's a lot of poverty. There's nothing you can do. Mm-hmm. I don't want it, and I don't think you're doing that. Obviously, you're not. But a transformational change in this city, if we cut child poverty in half, mm-hmm. if we cut it by 3/4, what might that change in RCSD?
I'm going to always take it back to mindset. It's your belief on whether or not the students that are in front of you are capable and able to do it. And unfortunately, at times, because our students come with the cards stacked against them, we automatically go into that deficit mode. Mm-hmm. And that includes educators that may be Black and brown. I used to be one of those individuals. The minute I got my first over $1,000 paycheck, I thought I was doing something. I did. And guess what? I then became the type of oppressor that has kept other students who needed me down. And so I had to do a lot of self-examination and saying, wait, DeMario, you were that kid. You were that kid. You are where you are because someone believed in you. And that's what it ultimately comes down to. And I know that, yes, you know, kids that have to worry about, you know, where their next meal is and things of that nature, that does stack against them. But when they come to school, they do come to school to learn. Parents send their kids to school to learn. They send their kid to school, possibly now, to also get a hot meal. They send their kids to school to have a safe environment. They send the kid to school to make sure that they can go to work. And we just have to do what we know is best, and that is to educate them and keep kids safe when they're under our care. That's our basic responsibility.
Well, what we're going to do in a moment, we have we're in the middle of a live broadcast from MCC. If you're just tuning in here, both hours from our MAPPIES Summit here, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, and we have a live audience, and we're going to invite them after we take a break to come to the microphone and ask questions, comments, if they so choose. Before we go to break, one more question for Simeon Bannister, and it's not to say that, I want to key in on the fact that you said we are learning a lot, and we have to be learning a lot. So nobody has it all figured out. But when you're really feeling either angry or righteous, what do you look at and say, I can't believe this hasn't changed, or I can't believe we're not doing X?
Yeah, I think I'm, confronted by some of the deep cynicism that continues to persist in this community. Earlier today, we were given name badges, and it said, what's the thing that you're working, the challenge you're trying to solve? And mine was cynicism. And it's because cynicism is a different species than apathy. Apathy, I just don't care. Cynicism suggests that nothing can change, that nothing I do is going to matter. Yet we see evidence that people can make decisions that bring about different outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so what's striking to me is that, for example, we saw during the pandemic, as was mentioned, that childhood poverty was cut by 36% in this country. So we know that that actually works. That's not like a wonder. I'm not even sure that we need to pilot, because we have the evidence that that approach works. So why don't we just do that, right? And it strikes me again that so much of why we don't is because it's very, very difficult to break old habits. And when we have been inculcated with this idea that merit equals economic success, it's really difficult for us to get beyond that, especially people that don't have a lot.
I think cynicism is the quality that sometimes manifests in myself that I like the least. But it is also very hard sometimes not to be. I often ask myself, am I being realistic or cynical right here? And if you're being realistic and you're being tough and you feel some despair, there may be reasons for despair at times. Mm-hmm. There may be reasons that when voters feel despair. But cynicism is really destructive. I just want to say I really appreciate you you're working on cynicism. And the sarcastic part of me would say good luck. But
tell me about it. We see all this gray hair I got since we started hanging out.
But the optimistic side of me says everyone's in this room because they're not going to let cynicism win the day here. So that's such a powerful message. It's such a powerful message. We are very late for the only break we're going to take. It's a short one, and we're right back. And we've got live audience questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. Senator J.D. Vance says that the United States has been too generous with handing out special immigrant visas to Afghans and Iraqis who worked with the United States as translators. We're going to talk to Ellen Smith from Keeping Our Promise, an organization working with SIVs. In our second hour, an upcoming Rochester Climate March. What are the organizers hoping to accomplish? This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Glad to be broadcasting with a live audience on the road from MCC downtown as part of our MAPPIES summit here, their third such summit. And we're talking to community leaders about poverty. We've been doing it all afternoon today. And I want to welcome some questions now. So earlier this hour, we saw people standing up, coming to microphones. If you've got a question, comment that you want to share, you can either, there we go. Let's start. Just a name first and then go ahead.
My name is Lydia Alston Murphy, and I actually have two questions, if I may. The first question is, what do you say to funders who roll out a pilot, get good results, and then decide to invest their funding someplace else? What do you say to those funders? And then the next question is, for the tax credits and the other funding that you guys mentioned that actually change the level of poverty for children, what do you say to people that say, oh my gosh, that adds to the deficit, we can't make those dollars available anymore? What do you say to those people?
Well, who wants to start here? DeMario, this is the superintendent of Rochester City School District.
I can tackle the first one only. The other one was a little bit loaded, but I have definitely seen a number of organizations want to come do something for the Rochester City School District, the Buffalo City School District that I was a part of before, and then decide to go ahead and take those services to the suburbs. We have to just be very clear on what those outcomes and expectations are going to be and plan accordingly to actually find out if the pilot is measured as a success, then how do we plan to scale this out to our other schools? So being very clear and meticulous in the beginning, when you come sit at my table and you're trying to do something for my school, I am going to really hold you accountable for those outcomes, and I am going to expect that you are ready to deal with another one of the inner city Rochester City School District schools to make sure that we continue to move forward.
Second,
I'm happy to take a crack at both of them. I'll start with the second one first, and then head on over to the first one. On the second one, what do I say to folks that raise that question about, you know, whether it's going to add to the deficit and so forth? I would say to those folks, they should learn how to do math. And the reason why is that we know that on the other side of the ledger, poverty has a cost, and it has a cost to society. And so when we think about, for example, the cost of the carceral state in this country, when we think about the costs of education in this country, and the challenges that Superintendent Strickland, who I just want to pause for a second and thank you for your vulnerability, because that takes a lot, just described, those are all costs that we bear. And so when we say we're going to make an investment in people that's going to yield a return in terms of reducing some of those costs, that makes a lot of sense to me. And that's what I would say to a lot of folks that raise those concerns. I would also say to them that when we make investments, for example, in, say, tax cuts to folks that don't need them, that also has a cost, especially when the underlying theory for that tax cut is that it's supposed to spur more job growth and creation and economic activity. When that doesn't happen, when it actually just ends up in a bank account somewhere, unfortunately, that also has a cost. So that's what I would say to that. For the first question on funders and pilots and so on and so forth, that is a much longer question, Lydia, than I think most people would appreciate. And the reason why that's such a long question is because it's an interesting question about the role of philanthropy and the role of philanthropy in relation to the role of government. I was just talking to some young people about this last week and explaining that one of the great things that philanthropy gets to do is to be risk capital. That we get to try things, that we get to do things. And I think one of the challenges is that philanthropy has often been put in the position of being sustaining capital. And that's not the best role for philanthropy because the resources don't aggregate in that way. And so there's a big conversation for us to have, certainly society, but I think even here in this community about how philanthropy works. And I think what we're seeing right now in some instances is the limits that philanthropy has as it relates to that kind of sustaining role.
Before I send it over to Aqua, can I just follow that point? When you talk about the limits because the resources don't aggregate, when I am feeling cynical, frankly, sometimes about philanthropy, I think, what is the first big structural issue that philanthropy solved? And I'm not talking about sending 200 kids to college, or I'm talking about a structural issue that was solved just by philanthropy. And the answer is usually, we can't think of any. But part of what I think you're saying is, let's reimagine how it works here. Philanthropy has a role to be kind of a lab of experimentation or trying, and when you really believe an idea, you figure out how to make it work, and then you find a way to sustain it beyond that first go. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly it. Because if you think about government, right, government almost fundamentally is risk averse. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The extent to which folks have to deal with elections and, you know, the challenges and consequences of elections can be really difficult to create the kind of adroitness and speed of action that we can do in philanthropy. Because I don't have an election. I don't have to go and run a race. My job is to steward resources as effectively as possible and very precious and limited resources as effectively as possible to facilitate that kind of change. Now, there are some folks that have engaged in the kind of philanthropy that's like sprinkling the magic charity dust, mm-hmm. right? The 200 kids to college approach. And there's, you know, I'm not going to, you know, denounce anybody's approach or anything like that. But what I know is that if we are smart about using these precious resources in ways that unlock new possibilities that are truly innovative, and that's a personal aspiration that I have for our community, I don't see any reason why Rochester, New York cannot be the leader of social innovation in this country. That is a goal that we can attain here. That's something we can do that can be transformative, not only for our community, but beyond. But that requires us to think differently.
Aqua, do you want to add to that?
I think the guys covered it.
next up in the audience here. Yes.
Ms. Inez Burns-Nixon, I'm a CAC member and also a community advocate. I have two questions. One question for the superintendent. I am a foster AmeriCorps grandparent at the early childhood school. I'm Grandma B. And I want you to know that I make a big impact in children with autism and kids that are struggling. And I feel that the grandparents need to be into those schools. We need a grandparent program bigger than AmeriCorps, because I make a difference when I walk down the hallway and I hear Grandma B all day. I know I have accomplished something to deal with. I'm talking to parents about jobs. I'm talking about education. I'm a referral service. So I'm more than a grandma. So we need to pick that program up in RCSD and get more grandparents into the school. First Samoan. I have a question about grants. What about the unsung heroes in the community that don't have a 503C, that don't have nobody to facilitate the money for them, but want to make a change in poverty? I feel that grants should be more accessible to people like me that want to make a change, but I don't have a building. I don't have a board. I don't have all the new technologies, but I can make a difference in my community, North Market View Heights, if I had the funding, little small grants. We're not asking for millions, just to make some changes in our community. I just want to see some of that change come into place.
Superintendent?
So as a former principal, I remember hosting grandparents in our schools. They would be in our kindergarten classrooms, first grade classrooms. Huge asset to the school community. They look like our kids. They talk like our kids. And, you know, when you get grandma's look, you start acting a little different. But that definitely is noted. And I do not think that we are against it. It might be some regulations or things that we have to cut through to enhance that program.
And as to your second question, one of the great opportunities that I have, and this is the reason why I am not cynical, is because I don't just deal with like classes or types of people. I get the good fortune of dealing with actual people. I get the good fortune of dealing with folks that do have some resources that come to us and say, I want to make a difference in this community. I actually do care about Rochester, and I want to contribute to this place. And they do so openly and willingly with eyes wide open for how they can be impactful. It absolutely strikes me that, and I'm glad to share with you, that at the Community Foundation, we are able to make grants to folks that aren't just the classic huge 501c3 that you typically think of. And in fact, that's been a real key strategy at the foundation, is to reposition resources so that we're able to drive dollars into places that they haven't typically gone. One of the projects that we work very closely with the mayor on is this idea of inclusive recovery. And we also work with the county executive to make sure that these ARPA dollars and some of the resources that came into this community would not go to the wrong places, the usual suspects, but could end up in the hands of people that were going to be transformative. But here's the flip side, and this is the important part. Remember, I said that my job is to be a steward of resources. That does not mean that we come around and tell people, wagging fingers and telling folks what to do. What it does mean is that we partner to share what we've learned, to learn from the partners that we're engaging so that we make the best possible choices. It is not free money time. It is not just throwing it around. And I actually think that some of the ways that we have used this term trust-based philanthropy have actually gotten away from its true meaning. Trust is a function of relationship. Trust is a function of getting to know one another so that then we're able to distribute resources. And so what we're encouraging folks is to get to know us, and we want to get to know you so that that way we can find the smartest and most efficient and most effective ways to distribute dollars into the community.
We got time for, it's got to be fast there, Todd Butler.
Save me from having to introduce myself. Simeon, you talked about cynicism, and I think it's a really, really important point. And I think cynicism is sometimes driven by evidence, but it's also driven by perception. But so is hope, and so is optimism.
That's right.
And our MAPI talks not just about poverty, but about upward mobility. And we heard today about actual improvements that are happening in our community. And if we believe that success begets success and hope begets hope, how can we all play a role in the narrative change that's really required, I believe, for mindset change and for community change?
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, that was the premise. We were so grateful to connect and work closely at the Community Foundation with through our collaboration partnership with our MAPI. I've been glad to be vice chair, as Aqua always reminds me. Part of that was really bringing to the fore this idea of upward mobility. There's a wonderful person who's been to town a few times named Tiffany Manuel. And she talks about this idea of strategic case making. And one of the things that she says is that we have a predisposition often to credential problems, but not credential solutions. So we talk a lot about problems. We present a lot of data about problems, but we don't talk as much about the things that are working, even if they're little flickers, even if they're things that show a little bit of hope. And I think one of the things that we want to encourage more folks to do, especially in a room like this, and also for the listeners, is maybe spend a little less time concentrating on the, we got it, we know, right? We've got high levels of childhood poverty. We've been hearing it for a long time. We got it. But what are the things that are working, and how do we credential those solutions, and even those people, including grassroots folks, how do we credential those so that we're able to invest more and accelerate our progress?
Aqua, about 30 seconds as we get ready to wrap. What do you want to leave with this audience?
I want to leave people with the idea of hope. I believe that this community has already shown that they're committed to working on the problem. I think we have to keep creating the political will to reallocate resources to places that are most needy, and we have to really do that with a vengeance and not be afraid, show some courage in making some of those decisions happen. I think we do have to encourage people to use the power that they have, especially people who come from marginalized communities who are not often represented. They must use their voice to make sure they're heard, whether it's at the ballot box or at their school board meetings or in their churches, wherever they are, there are where people make decisions for them, they have to be there.
I want to encourage our live audience to thank our guests here, Aqua Porter, DeMario Strickland, Simeon Bannister. Our thanks to Rochester Mayor Malik Evans earlier this hour. We've been broadcasting live from MCC downtown. And our entire crew here, who I wouldn't even have time to mention everybody here. I just want to say, if you're part of the WXXI crew, thank you. You're underappreciated. Great work, everyone. Thank you to all the listeners, and we'll be back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.